Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Shasai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, a COVID-19 outbreak hits the Six Nations community in Ontario, cases on the rise, new measures implemented. COVID-19 has also hit Sackville's Mel's Tea Room. It will be closing its doors on a 77-year history.
Nothing lasts forever. It's sad, but it's a reality. I guess if a place has to go down, at least it went down honorably.
CFRC Radio celebrates its 100th birthday. The executive director of the Community Radio Fund of Canada was there.
This is the place where those original voices get their first moments to have a microphone in front of them. And it's a really special moment. These are the people that live in the community. These are the people that live and die by what goes out and over that signal. And that's pretty special.
And Revelstoke, BC will soon get its first electric school bus. Megan Dooling takes us for a ride.
I do love it. It's awesome. I love the kids. They're just great.
A silent disco DJ offers neighborhood-friendly dance parties on Cortes Island, British Columbia. And Indigenous organizations in British Columbia will be working together to reduce diesel use in remote communities.
It's a pretty significant opportunity to not only decrease reliance on diesel, but also provide them with energy sovereignty, provide them with clean air, lower noise pollution.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Oshawican Public Health has declared a COVID-19 outbreak at Iroquois Lodge after two residents tested positive for COVID-19 via a rapid test on September 28. There are now 16 cases among residents and 7 cases among staff. Here's David Moses in Oshawican, Ontario.
Oshawican Public Health has declared a COVID-19 outbreak at Iroquois Lodge after two residents tested positive for COVID-19 via a rapid test on September 28th. The individuals were immediately placed in isolation and were administered PCR tests to be sent to the lab for further confirmation of a positive result. However, since then, the total number of positive COVID-19 cases at Iroquois Lodge has risen to 16 cases among residents and 7 cases among staff. In accordance with protocol, Oshawican Public Health declared a COVID-19 outbreak and directed staff to isolate any positive cases and those who were in close contact with those individuals. As a result, only 2 designated caregivers are now allowed to visit per resident at this time, and no general visitors will be allowed during the outbreak. Additionally, 1 personal support worker team will be assigned to isolation rooms and will be separated from other staff and facilities to limit any further potential spread of the virus. Residents' family members have been notified and are receiving regular updates on the situation by lodge staff. CKRZ did reach out to Oshawican Public Health for an update to this story and was told that 1 additional resident has now also tested positive, increasing the total number of residents to 17.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
And we stay in Ontario and move to Kingston, where CFRC Radio celebrated its 100th birthday. The radio was launched on October 7, 1922 at Queen's University. 100 years later, a centennial plaque was unveiled outside the CFRC studios to commemorate the station's legacy. Former station manager Steve Cutway presented 2 achievement awards to long-standing volunteers Wayne Vermette and Jim Birch, recognizing their 40 years of broadcast. Vermette was with us in the past week. Mayor Brian Patterson, MPP Ted Sue, Queen's Principal Patrick Dean, and Executive Director of the Community Fund of Canada, Alex Friedman, were also at the ceremony and shared their thoughts on the value of the station. In Kingston, Ontario, here's Karen Musna. He meets up with the Community Radio Fund of Canada Executive Director, Alex Friedman.
This is Canada's oldest campus radio station. What do you feel that says about the power of campus radio?
Campus radio occupies a very special place in Canada's broadcasting world. It is a part of the community. These are volunteers from the community. It is run by people from the community, and it is run for the community. These are the voices of the community. When we think about who we are as a society, We are made up of the people who surround us. And campus radio connects those voices. Campus radio is the first place you hear those early Canadian artists. People like Katie Lang got her start on campus radio. The early DJ, Sheila Rogers, started on this radio station so many years ago. This is the place where those original voices get their first moments to have a microphone in front of them. And it's a really special moment. So it's a really unique place that a station like this plays in this community, and it's a real honor to be here to celebrate the 100th anniversary.
I understand a big part of your work is lobbying governments. Tell me about some of the challenges and maybe some of the misperceptions around campus radio that maybe you come across.
People don't understand that these are truly the only broadcasters who are there on the ground in the community. And when you think about stations that have much more subsidies or much more advertising, that kind of come in and leave. And that's a great, that you know, they have their role. These are the people that live in the community. These are the people that live and die by what goes out and over that signal. And that's pretty special.
That's a very good point. With more and more, voice tracked and perhaps lack of local news on many radio stations, that's... as you're saying, like, we still have that. We still have people here in the community, talking to people in the community. Tell me a little bit more about what people should really know about a radio station like this.
Well, look, you touched on something. We live in an age of disinformation, and it's politicians are making hay off of undermining the local information. There's a lot of literature out there, and there's no question that the front lines against disinformation is local news, local media, local voice. Why? Because we trust them. I've said this before. We know them. We trust them. We know that they're impacted by the information in the same way we are. So when I see a tweet from CFRC, I know that it comes from people who are here. When I'm trying to cut through the chaff on social media, I know that I can trust the people from this station because you know where they're coming from. And quite frankly, if you don't like it, you know where they are, right? And so that's what's so important. So as a voice in the fight against disinformation, and I'm not going to, this is not overly dramatic. Stations like this are the front lines in the fight for our democracy. This is where people have access to the airwaves like nowhere else. And if we don't preserve places like this, voices like this, access to Canadian airwaves like this, our whole society is in a lot of trouble.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
CFRC Radio has launched its annual funding drive to support a new website and to fund a summer radio theater camp for youth. Please go to canada-info.ca for the full stories. Revelstoke's first electric school bus will take over the Arrow Heights route as soon as next week in British Columbia. The bus is charged and the driver is trained. The bus just needs a radio installed and a final approval from the Department of Transportation before it's ready to go. Sonia Cinelli will be driving the electric bus. She says that learning to drive it was nerve-wracking, but now she's as comfortable with it as a diesel bus. When the school district asked the drivers in Revelstoke if anyone wanted to use an electric bus, Sonia was the only person to come forward. With the help of the students on her route, she's already named the bus Electric Eleanor, or EE for short. Megan Dooling, posted in Revelstoke, BC, was just in time to catch the bus.
It's got quite a bit of pep, for sure. I'm pretty happy with the pickup of it.
My name is Sonia Cinelli, and I work for School District 19. I'm a school bus driver, and I'm looking forward to taking this electric bus on my route.
School District 19 ordered this electric bus last spring. They asked the drivers if anyone was interested in being trained on it, and Cinelli stepped forward.
Well, we had a gentleman come in and go over the components, and it was nerve-wracking to hear, to say the least, but Norm is a phenomenal guy, and I'm just as confident feeling driving this than I am my diesel bus. No problem with it.
Cinelli is the only one driving an electric bus, but every driver, including those who work on call, were trained to drive it.
It's interesting. It was a lot to learn, and I'm glad. Yeah. It's refreshing.
These buses go for $400,000. Revelstoke's school district ended up paying $212,000 for it because they got third-party grants and help from the province to cover part of the cost. Still, that's around $20,000 more than a diesel bus costs. Bruce Tisdell is the secretary treasurer for School District 19. He says this bus costs 80% less to maintain and operate than a diesel bus.
So we're talking 2 to 3 years and we'll break even on the maintenance costs.
This bus does have a 20-liter tank for diesel, but it's just for heating. The batteries that run the bus lie in the mid-interior, meaning there's no cargo space. That means this bus can't be used for field trips or to take students up to the ski hill, for example, because there's no room for them to bring gear. Sinelli has done her homework, reading the manual and practicing on this bus.
This actually has the braking system, which is a regenerative braking system, and you got 3 settings to it. And that actually puts power back to the bus.
Her route is Arrow Heights.
So I go all the way to the end of Green Slide, turn around, pick up, drop off 6 times a day, 5 days a week. Truly, I do love it. It's awesome. I love the kids. They're just great. I really enjoy the kids. Makes your day just pleasant, that's for sure. And especially when they're just so appreciative as well and great and they're learning and it's good.
She drives over 100 kilometers a day.
There's a lot of stuff you get to hear.
Yeah,
I bet. And I love it. It's really good.
For now, Sinelli is still driving a diesel bus. The electric bus needs a radio installed, and it needs a final stamp of approval from the Department of Transportation. Tisdell expects it to be on the road for good next week.
Kind of sounds like it's just not normal. And that little hum that you hear, that's actually a sound that they put into it so you can hear it.
I'm Megan Dooling.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
And speaking about converting to cleaner energy, some Indigenous organizations in British Columbia will be working together to reduce diesel use in remote communities. A partnership was formed between Coast Funds and New Relationship Trust to distribute $29 million in funding for the Community Energy Diesel Reduction Program. These grants aim to support remote Indigenous communities in BC that rely on the diesel generators for their energy needs and that wish to convert to cleaner technologies. The partnership was formed in September 2021 as a response to the Ministry of Energy, Mines and Low Carbon Innovation call to deliver the funding. Several communities in Northwest BC rely on the diesel generators to produce electricity, like Hartley Bay, Dees Lake, Telegraph Creek, and Masset, though there have been a total of 44 communities recognized in BC that rely on diesel. With 19.1 million liters of diesel consumed by remote communities in 2019, the Community Energy Diesel Reduction Program says it hopes to help reduce that number by 80% by 2030. More on this with Morgan Budden in Terrace, British Columbia.
$29 million in funding is now available for remote Indigenous communities that rely on diesel generators for their energy needs. The Community Energy Diesel Reduction Program is a collection of 3 grant streams that can support communities throughout the process of switching to clean energy. Several communities in the Northwest rely on diesel-powered energy sources like Hartley Bay, Dajangeats, and Iskut. Though while forming this plan, the provincial government identified 44 communities across BC that are eligible for the funding. In order to distribute the funding, Coast Funds and the New Relationship Trust formed a partnership. Sarah Powell, a program specialist for the New Relationship Trust, explained how this partnership started.
So the partnership between Coast Funds and New Relationship Trust started when the province put out a call for administrators for their new $29 million funding program. And New Relationship Trust covers the entirety of BC, whereas Coast Funds only covers select nations within the Great Bear Rainforest. But we quickly realized on both of our ends that the $29 million project was way too big for either of our organizations to handle on our own. And we were both aware of each other's organizations, as we have very similar goals in providing funding and capacity support to First Nations. So we decided just to join a call, and we knew we both needed people with experience, and we decided that we could provide the best service to communities within this program if we work together.
Both organizations will work to assist communities throughout the process of applying and implementing the funding from each of the three grants. Eddie Adra, the CEO of Coast Funds, explained what each stream aims to accomplish.
A multi-pronged program that meets community needs to develop community energy plans or even update them, to reduce energy consumption through efficient demand-side management solutions, and also to fund renewable energy projects from planning, development, all the way through to construction.
Along with the aim to reduce diesel use by 80% by 2030, Adger expressed some of the other possible benefits of the program.
It's a pretty significant opportunity to not only decrease reliance on diesel, but also provide them with energy sovereignty, so not being reliant on trying to connect with a BC Hydro line that may be too far away from their community, or trying to be reliant on diesel being barged over. If it's a coastal community, for example, barged over from Vancouver all the way to a northern community. It really helps address those needs. It provides them with clean air, lower noise pollution, which most people don't think about a clean energy project as a noise pollution canceling the project. But when you go up to those communities that have those large diesel generators, those are pretty loud. And so there's actually quite a few benefits from these projects.
Established just this past summer, the program is already looking to announce a list of approved projects by November. This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. To read the full story, visit canada-info.ca.
And it's a sad day in Sackville, New Brunswick. Mel's Tea Room, which had been designated a local historic place back in 2006, is closing its doors, hit hard by COVID-19 measures and roofing problems. And with it, a 77-year-old love affair with the city's residents. The Mel's building is also known as the Cahill Block and predates the tea room business by a number of decades. The Cahill Block was built in 1913, a year after a major fire burned the original building on Lower Bridge Street. Then in 1944, Melbourne Goodwin purchased the building and renovated the bottom floor to accommodate his tea room, which has been operating elsewhere since 1919. The Goodwin family owned and operated Mel's Tea Room until Roger Goodwin sold the business and then the building to Ken Mikolaskas in 2012 and 2017. Over its 77 years, Mel's Tea Room served as a diner, coffee shop, a magazine stand, intercity bus depot, convenience store, and gathering place. Generations of Mount Allison University students and Sackvillians know the spot. And in the 1990s, it inspired poet Douglas Lougheed, who published Breakfast at Mel's and other poems of love and places. Owners Dave and Wendy Epworth are devastated. Some people in the Sangville community are even mobilizing to help make sure the Epworths can recover financially. Here's Erica Butler.
We could not sell the business as it was, which is totally understandable given the times. We're going to liquidate what we can and try and keep our heads above water somewhat on the personal side of things.
This must be a difficult time. I know, Wendy, you spoken before about how you really didn't want this sort of bird to die in your hand kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's devastating not only to our family, but I know to the entire town, and we're sorry. Like, we've thought about this for months, trying to figure out how to salvage it, how to keep going, but the cards we've been dealt, not just through COVID, but with the kitchen ceiling collapse and, you know, being completely shut down since February is just, you know, I don't think many people could come back from that, and we aren't able to.
The hope was to find someone to take over the business, and now, as you say, you're looking at liquidating what's in here. Pretty much everything belongs to the business here. So will there be anything left? I mean, including the sign outside, everything here, like it all must go, I guess.
Everything must go. Yeah. It's, you're sort of hoping to sell people's memories back to them, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. Like the sale of the sign is gut wrenching. Not just to us, but I know to a lot of people in Sackville, but what Dave is saying is just right. When we bought the business, we paid significant money for the goodwill of the business, for the brand of the business. And so we essentially cannot afford to do that. That's why we were hoping desperately to sell it, to someone else at, you know, for a, at a loss, for a very good price, but it didn't happen. You know, unfortunately, that sign is a major asset of this business. And if the, you know, the people coming in aren't willing to buy it from us, then that essentially means that somebody's banking on the fact that we can't actually remove it.
There hasn't been any interest from the new owners of the building. I have reached out to the new owners of the building, but haven't heard back. But has there been no interest from them to buy any of what's here, including the sign, to keep with the building?
So, yes, they have. They have asked us what we want for the sign. It's a very difficult thing to put a value on. So we're really trying to figure out what that's worth. I mean, there is value in, you know, being able to leave it in a way, because I know that Sackville would really, really appreciate that. So we'll see where that conversation goes.
Have the new owners shared with you any of their plans? I mean, this is very much a restaurant space. Can't imagine anything else being in here at the moment, but have they shared anything with you what their long-term plans are?
One of the parties that came through to look at it were thinking about running a restaurant in here. But our understanding is that they do not want any of the equipment or assets. So that's why we're in the position we're in, where we have to sell it, sell everything we can.
Now, you can't sell the floor, which you refinished. You can't really sell the bathroom, which you renovated and or created a new bathroom. I mean, will these booths get sold? Like, I guess for people who are very familiar with this space, know it well, will literally everything be gone?
Nothing lasts forever. It's sad, but it's a reality. And I mean, I guess if a place has to go down, at least it went down honorably, if that makes any sense. Like, it's
extenuating circumstances. Yeah, very extreme circumstances led to this. And there wasn't, you know, it wasn't for lack of caring or lack of trying. We fought pretty hard. We fought for 3 years. None of us will get to see what it could have been again, you know. We'll do our best to, you know, share what little bits of memorabilia there are. We're photographing things. So stay tuned for that, I guess.
And if anybody has any dry storage areas.
Okay, well.
We've sort of been struggling with, we don't want to just pack everything into a little space and have it forgotten. If we're going to sell some of the memories of Mel's, we can't stick them in a container somewhere and let them just decay, you know. That's sort of the challenge right now, is trying to figure out, where does the stuff go? Like everything else in life, we'll figure it out.
There's always irons on the fire, says Dave, and indeed, the couple have expressed interest in becoming the new operators of the Tantramar Civic Center canteen, as former operator Marianne Oster, owner of the snack shop, steps back from the job. Mary Lloyd is the Sun and Disco DJ, an artist based in Victoria. She began organizing discos on the beaches of Smelt Bay in the past summer and fall. The enthusiastic DJ hopes to offer a monthly opportunity to gather and dance on Cortes Island. In the silent disco, wireless headsets are distributed to participants who then all tune in to the same DJ set broadcasted to the headsets. The experience offers a silent veil to those surrounding the dance. Lonely Taylor investigates what can be seen but not heard. She's with Mary Lloyd.
You've done a couple of silent discos over the summer now, right?
Yeah, always at Smelt Bay so far. Did one in May and it was super fun. And the tide was way out 300 meters and I was a little shocked. Said low tide, but it was this little tiny little bit of sand to dance in. But it was fun. We just spread out to the sides and the grass behind. We were allowed, given permission to dance on the grass behind. So it was lovely. It was a really hot day for October. Yeah, it went really well. And then it's been suggested that I do another one at Manson's Lagoon with when it's sunset or night and you can have the glowing. Yeah, that would be fun. But I love doing sunset dances. That's normally what I do in sunset and full moon. I do a monthly full moon dance in Victoria. I've been doing that for about over 2 years. And it's a circle. We have a circle and then we do a ecstatic dance. And then I also do a weekly dance on a beach there. I've been doing that for over 2 years too. At least once a week, I've got something going on. Yeah. I have been called intrepid and I have done outdoor dances year round. And in Victoria, even on New Year's Day, we did a dance in the snow. We had an actual fire in the middle of the field and a pot. And then we did a ritual of releasing and letting go, and people loved it. But yeah, I usually have a fire pot and candles and make it really beautiful. Yeah, so I would continue doing outdoors if there was interest and we could find good locations. I love to do a forest dance if we could do a forest dance. And I did training as a dance your abilities facilitator, dance as medicine facilitator. So I'm certified in those. And I do offer a K-3 class where they can do their own moves and then everyone copies their moves. And there's a whole, and we can even do it like right in town too. But no, I do all kinds of genres. So I'm open. And I will do popular stuff. I'm not that familiar with pop music, but if people give me artists and...
Lonnie Taylor.
And that's it for us. Our collaborators this week, Erica Butler, David Moses, Lonnie Taylor, Morgan Budd, and Megan Dooling, and Karen Musna. Our national coordinator, Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Just a reminder that you can tune into all our past programs and stories on canada-info.ca. Nice to have you with us. Take care. See you next week.